From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. Welcome, Catherine and Steve.
Good to be here.
Same here. Thanks for having us.
Well, the biggest moment of the U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee's investigation of the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol building arrived with televised hearings broadcast in prime time by most major U.S. networks and news channels. The 9-member panel of 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans blamed former President Donald Trump for the riot, saying the assault was hardly spontaneous but an attempted coup and a direct result of the defeated president's effort to overturn the 2020 election. Representative Liz Cheney, one of the 2 Republicans and the panel's vice chair, took the lead for much of the hearing. She said, quote, President Trump summoned a violent mob, unquote. The committee presented previously unseen material, witness testimony, and previewed additional hearings to provide the American people a summary of its findings. The House of Representatives passed a sweeping gun package in response to last month's shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas, that killed more than 30 people and reignited the push for firearm legislation on Capitol Hill. The package faces certain resistance in the Senate, where at least 10 Republicans are needed to overcome a legislative filibuster. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of continuing to, quote, blackmail the world with famine, unquote, by blockading Ukrainian ports and preventing exports of wheat, corn, vegetable oil, and other food products. UN Chief Antonio Guterres says the consequences for the world of Russia's invasion of Ukraine are worsening, affecting 1.6 billion people. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. In looking at this aspect of the investigation, let's look at some of the most dramatic highlights of this first hearing.
I think what we really will remember from this first primetime hearing is that 12-minute video package of previously unseen footage from within the U.S. Capitol that was really at times quite intense, that left the committee hearing room silent and indeed left some of the family members of the U.S. Capitol police officers who lost their lives because of that day quietly sobbing. You know, we've seen some of this footage already during the impeachment in 2021, when former President Trump was impeached for inciting that riot. So we've already gotten a sense of the scope of what happened that day, but this was much more intense. This was body camera footage from Capitol police officers, security camera footage from within the halls of the U.S. Capitol, and it really reinforced the seriousness of that day. Because we've heard in the time since from some congressional Republicans that this was simply people going into the U.S. Capitol as tourists, people going into the U.S. Capitol peacefully. We saw with our own eyes visuals last night that this indeed wasn't the case.
The hand-to-hand combat that the video showed, I had seen everything, watched the impeachment hearings, and saw all of that video, as Catherine mentioned. This video was stark. It was up close. You could almost feel, especially with the body cam video, the police officers struggling to just do their jobs. I also thought that the video provided by the documentarian who was embedded with the Proud Boys was eye-opening, especially that meeting in a garage between the leaders, the right-wing militias, the Proud Boys, and a rival militia, the Oath Keepers. That video was maybe about 10 seconds, but for me, it told me that there was a lot of planning going on ahead of this riot. So the video, I thought, really struck a chord, at least with me and the people that were watching with me. Oh my gosh, that's what happened on January 6th. Even though we saw so much before, I felt that this was just eye-opening and lived up to the billing that the members of the committee raised the expectations ahead of it by telling us there would be never seen before video and never before heard information about the attack. Thursday's hearing lived up to that billing.
And I would add that even though it was much less intense, it was also incredibly important to hear some of those videotaped depositions, which I'm sure we'll get into more, but from Bill Barr, from the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, from everyone around former President Trump saying, look, we were telling him that this was not a rigged election, that this election was not stolen from him, that everyone around the president in the days leading up to January 6th knew that he was pushing false claims of a stolen election and were trying to convey that information to him. I thought that was also particularly effective as well.
The pains that the committee took to show that President Trump knew he had lost the election, that he heard from his closest advisors, even his family, that there was no voter fraud, as he consistently claimed, both before and after the election. They all knew and told him as much, yet he continued to, as the committee is trying to show, press his case and summoning the mob to Washington on January 6th. It's hard to show anybody's state of mind in a courtroom or any other kind of venue. But when you have people on videotape testifying under the law, I thought that was incredibly effective to show that this wasn't just some spontaneous protest. This was carefully planned. And as the committee is trying to show, the former president was right in the middle of all of that planning.
As you all pointed out, that 12-minute video of the extremists going towards the Capitol, this was all very, very riveting. As far as the video aspect of this, what can we expect going forward?
Well, what we heard from Liz Cheney was a detailed plan for what's going to be happening in the hearings ahead. She said that there was a 7-part conspiracy on the part of former President Trump to advance his false claims of a rigged election and to hold on to the power of the presidency in what she flat out called a coup. And so over the course of these next few hearings, she said that we're going to be hearing about the president's links to extremist groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. We heard a little bit of that from the documentary filmmaker. We're also going to be hearing about how the president tried to remove people from within the own U.S. Justice Department to advance his own false claims. And then ultimately, on the day of January 6th, refused to send any help to the U.S. Capitol, which, you know, many Republicans during the impeachment process cited as a reason for their impeachment vote. So we're going to see all of that laid out in a very thorough manner over the next 2 weeks. The committee did a really good job of showing us how they see this case and how they're going to lay out the case before the American people.
One of the other major revelations that I found jolting, that several members of Congress sought presidential pardons for their roles in trying to overturn the election results. That's a little bit of a cliffhanger that I think that the committee co-chair Liz Cheney delivered, and it's likely something to come back to as the hearings move forward, was how much were members of Congress complicit or aiding in this plan to either overturn the election or prevent the votes from being counted. As well, I thought the most compelling moment was the testimony of the Capitol Police officer, Caroline Edwards. She described what happened to her that day. She was among the first of the Capitol Police officers to encounter the mob. There was video to back up her words as to what happened that day. I thought it humanized not just her, but the whole police force that were there trying to do their jobs, protecting the building and the occupants and getting swallowed up in the attack. I felt that her courage, both that day, not only did she get injured and knocked out at the very beginning of the mob attack, she came back and went to various different positions to try and hold the line. She became a real human embodiment of what went on that day. And I thought that the committee did a very good job of being able to show that here is an everyday person trying to do their job and getting swallowed up in the attack. And I thought that did a lot to help their case in prosecuting their case.
That's right, because it's just the way she was able to say, look, I am a U.S. Capitol Police officer. I'm trained in crowd control, but I am not trained in combat. And that moment that she described of finally seeing the scope of the rioters coming towards the U.S. Capitol en masse and saying it looked like it was a war zone. I was slipping in my friend's blood. I've watched video of that Capitol attack. I've seen some of the hand-to-hand fighting, but I've never heard it described in quite that way, where I understood how it felt to be in that moment and that what it was like to actually see an attack on the U.S. Capitol, not just a riot, an attack. And she was really able to effectively convey that.
I just wanted to circle back to something that Catherine said a moment ago, that President Trump did not make any calls for help. Many Republicans have been saying, where was the response to President Trump's call for the National Guard to come out and help put down the attack? Well, President Trump never made that call, never asked for that, according to the committee. We heard from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. He testified that Vice President Pence called him three times as he was in the bowels of the Capitol building, being protected, waiting out the attack. He called the general to try and figure out how to put down the riot and what help to get out there. Milley said he never heard from the president that day. The only time he heard from the White House was later on in the day, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and he was much more concerned about the narrative that Vice President Pence was engaged in putting the riot down while President Trump was not, and changing that narrative with the general rather than anything else that was going on that day.
That's interesting. I'm glad that you did bring up that point, because Republicans are saying that former President Trump, who was president at the time, did make the call to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and then it was up to her to enforce the National Guard.
That call, apparently, according to the committee, never was made.
Right.
Good point. Well, let's look at the role of Representative Liz Cheney. She's a Wyoming Republican, and she's not only embraced her role as a leading figure in this investigation, but she's also assumed the GOP face of the anti-Trump movement in the process. Also, I guess there's a political aspect as well, because her future in politics could hinge on her success of this investigation, considering that former President Trump had captured 70% of the vote in Wyoming in 2020.
You know, that's right. I was actually talking to a political reporter from her home state earlier this week about all of the political implications of this for her. And it sounds like it's a very tough situation on the ground, because her constituents, her voters, are worried about inflation. They're worried about baby formula shortages, about price hikes. They're worried about the economy. They have a whole host of concerns here domestically. And the reporter was telling me that there's a sense that Cheney has perhaps taken this a little bit too far, that she has really held on to this issue much longer than the voters want her to. So she's really making a stand against her own party yet again, after they stripped her of her position in House Republican leadership, and making a stand and saying, look, this is a threat of our democracy. This undermines the foundations of our very country. And while there may be pressing issues domestically at home, this ultimately calls into question whether this country can function democratically. That's a very tough calculation for her, and it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Many political observers are commenting about Liz Cheney's political courage in taking on this fight. There is no more rock-ribbed Republican in the U.S. Congress than Liz Cheney. Her father was a Republican congressman from Wyoming. He served as vice president. He served as chief of staff to President Ford. He was vice president to George W. Bush. There's no better credentialed conservative Republican than Liz Cheney, and she's going up against the former president of the United States and many others in her Republican Party. She sent a direct message to her fellow Republicans that their continued support for the narrative of what happened, that it wasn't such a big deal, that it was just a bunch of tourists, that it was peaceful. She pointed out to her Republican colleagues that one day President Trump will eventually exit the scene. while he is gone, the dishonor of what they have done in supporting the president's theories about the election and support for the January 6th insurrection, she said it will be a dishonor to them once Trump eventually goes away.
Right. And it was a very effective moment when she reminded everyone that members of Congress take their oath of office to the U.S. Constitution, not to a party, not to a president, not to anyone ideology, to the U.S. Constitution. And every congressional Republican who supported Trump that day on January 6th violated that oath of office.
The committee has a difficult job. It's got many different audiences. It's got the audience of the general American public, as well as the rest of the world wondering what the heck is going on in the United States. They've got the U.S. public to talk to. They also have the Republican Party to talk to, as well as the U.S. Justice Department and the Attorney General, laying out the blueprint for law enforcement to use to prosecute those involved. So having the committee try to be able to plainly explain it to the American public while trying to also show prosecutors this is the direction to go, as well as convince Republicans that you've been lied to for the last year and a half, it's a difficult lift for the committee to carry out. I thought Thursday night they started out very well by focusing the video and the sound and focusing it on President Trump.
Very good analysis of the whole televised hearing. We need to move on to get our next topics in, and we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, the U.S. House of Representatives passes a wide-ranging gun control bill in response to recent mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voaafrica.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. Well, the U.S. House passed a sweeping gun package in response to recent mass shootings here in the U.S. So, Catherine, how sure are Democrats that this will pass in the Senate? And if not, what will be their next step?
Well, they aren't certain at all at this point as to whether or not that will pass in the U.S. Senate, because there are ongoing negotiations between Democrats and Republicans about how exactly to get that House legislation over into the U.S. Senate in a form that can pass the filibuster, that can garner those 10 Senate Republicans and get the votes needed to pass and then go on to the White House for Joe Biden's signature to be signed into law. There's a lot of negotiation right now about that age for owning an AR-15. You may remember that the Uvalde gunman was 18 years old, just barely, when he bought that AR-15 assault rifle that was able to kill so many so quickly. There's a lot of talks about raising that age to age 21. There's also some discussion of limits on gun magazines. All of those issues came up in a very powerful, emotional House hearing earlier this week, where we heard from some of the parents of the victims of those children who died in Uvalde, Texas, as well as some of the survivors themselves. And the purpose of that hearing was really to keep this issue in the public consciousness in a very emotional, intense way. You know, we've seen in the past in the United States, we have these mass shootings. There are a couple of days in the news cycle where everybody is horrified, paying attention, and then it's hard to say, but it does fade from the public consciousness, and it's hard for lawmakers, particularly Democratic lawmakers, to marshal the momentum to pass gun laws. So they're really trying this time around to keep the focus on the victims so that people remember their passion for this issue and they want to see some change in the wake of these mass shootings.
And Americans want to see some change. New polls show, as well as old polls show, a majority of Americans want new, stricter gun laws. There's overwhelming support for background checks for all gun sales, along with so-called red flag laws, which allows the government to confiscate weapons from people who are considered at risk for violent behavior.
And also, some Republicans have called for measures to increase school security and to encourage measures to address mental health. So how is this being incorporated into legislation, or is it?
Well, there were some calls in that House hearing to use leftover funds from the COVID funding to then refunnel that into school security. We've heard some Republicans argue that a single locked door in the Uvalde, Texas school would have prevented the shooter from entering that schoolroom and shooting all of those children and the teachers. We heard from a couple of experts saying that when you look at the actual data, these changes don't actually prevent most mass shootings. So there's definitely a very different worldview on each of these parts, where Republicans simply don't see more checks on guns as the answer for this. They are arguing that the Second Amendment rights of the U.S. people are important, should come first, and that punishing responsible gun ownership for a very, very small minority of what is often acknowledged to be mentally ill young gunmen will not solve the problem.
Very good point. And moving on to our last topic, Ukrainian and Russian forces battled fiercely for control of a key eastern city while fears of a global food crisis escalated as millions of tons of grain pile up inside of the country, unable to be exported by sea because of the war. Now, Russia is blaming the looming food crisis on Western sanctions against Moscow. So at this point, with millions of people in desperate need of grain, what do you see is going to happen with this situation?
Earlier in the week, Turkey tried to take the lead in talks with Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov of Russia to get Russia to lower their blockade, allow ships to load wheat and other food exports from Ukraine, and get it out of the country by ship. So far, there's been no movement. There are efforts underway to move these food commodities out of Ukraine by rail and truck. But there are lots of challenges to both of those methods. Trucks and rail, they can't carry as much product as the ships can. There are many logistical hurdles to overcome, like getting enough people to load all of the grain onto trains and trucks and getting truck drivers to come into Ukraine, get it loaded, and then drive out. Ukraine's railroads are from the Soviet era. They're built with different spacing between the rails than railroads throughout the rest of Europe and the rest of the world. So rail cars can only get as far as Ukraine's border with Poland or Romania before needing to be offloaded off the trains and then put onto other trains to finish the journey to markets around the world. So right now, it doesn't seem like the grain is going to be moving much in a direction to the rest of the world. That said, Russia says 3,000 tons of grain is going to be shipped from the Luhansk region of Ukraine that Russia controls back up to Russia so that Russia can then export it to the rest of the world.
Analysts suggest that this consequence of the war with the food crisis could open up the possibility of a negotiated settlement between Russia and Ukraine. Do you think that is possible that this could happen? And then what kind of a settlement would that be?
There is a lot of international pressure. It's not overt, but there is international pressure from some high-powered former diplomats, including the former U.S. Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, who says there should be a negotiated settlement and that Ukraine ought to expect to give up some land. President Zelensky has said that Ukraine will not cede any land and expects Russia to recall its troops and move back behind their borders before any of these talks on a negotiated settlement could begin. So it looks like that kind of stalemate is going to continue until Russia makes so much more of an advance into Ukraine that it's going to tie Zelensky's hands and he's going to be forced to the negotiation table.
We will have to see what the future, even the near future, will hold in this situation. And we're going to have to end the show on that note as we are out of time. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to visit us on our new website at voaafrica.com. And thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.